The Juneau World Affairs Council presents Turkey, Iran, and the U.S., International Tensions Under the Trump Administration, with NPR correspondent Peter Kenyon. Kenyon is a former Alaska Public Radio reporter who began his public radio career in Petersburg. He's been based in Istanbul since 2010 and previously covered the Middle East, North Africa, and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Thank you very much. Great to see everybody here when the sun is out. I wasn't expecting that. And even some people who've had to listen to me before. So welcome again. It's not going to be that different. But it is really good to be back, and I'm glad so many people are interested in this crazy part of the world that I cover. I'll talk a little bit about that, a little bit about journalism, and most of it's going to be questions, so I hope you have a few, because I don't have a very long spiel. As you heard, I started in Petersburg. I came up here and got to watch them try to impeach the governor, and then there was an oil spill, and then I got to be the host up in... Can I do that? I don't know why we're getting feedback. And then I had the chance to host Alaska News Nightly for several years, which was great fun. And then I kept going to a succession of stranger and stranger places, starting with Washington, D.C. And fortunately, my wife, an Alaska fisherwoman, agreed to go along, and still does. So I was in Jerusalem 01 to 05. That was the time of the Second Intifada, lots of conflict. I got thrown into war reporting and learned it sort of on the fly. Egypt was the last 6 years of Hosni Mubarak. I thought not much was going to happen. I handed off to my successor and said, here, you'll travel a lot. And then 6 months later was the Arab Spring, and he was toppled. So I definitely missed that one. And then Istanbul since 2010, which has been a succession of years of watching President Recep Tayyip Erdogan move from being the reformer and hope for the Middle East and a pious Muslim running a secular government to someone who's getting more and more authoritarian all the time and raising more concerns and more eyebrows. So I spent a lot of time covering that and also a lot of time covering Iran, which just had come through this very rare moment when you had a pragmatic Iranian president. He's not a moderate, but he is willing to talk to other countries, President Hassan Rouhani. And you had an administration in Washington that was willing to be less than openly hostile all the time to Iran. And so they created this Iran nuclear deal. I spent many, many hours in Vienna and Geneva waiting for them to come out and say they'd finally figured this out. And then comes Donald J. Trump, and that's all out the window, and that's been pulled, and one set of sanctions has already gone back on Iran, and another one, the big one, oil sanctions, comes up in November, right about the time of our midterm elections, I think. And Europe and Russia and China say they're going to, you know, fight back and keep trading despite the American sanctions, but whether they've got a viable plan to do that is not entirely clear. So there's a lot of uncertainty in all these relationships at this time. This audience, you probably did see the news today, which involved both Turkey and Iran, that they think they've got a DMZ set up for Idlib province in the north of Syria, which is right near Turkey. That's where, over the last several years, as the Assad regime has made deals to clear out rebel opposition fighters, he's put them all on a bus with their weapons and said, you can go to Idlib. So they're all there, the ones who haven't already left through Turkey. And now he wants to bomb them all, which would create another 3 million refugees, probably, to go on top of the 3.5 already in Turkey. And Europe is reiterating its commitment to not take any of them if they can possibly help it. So it's a very difficult issue at this point, and it's notable for the absence of American presence, at least in public. You know, it's always possible there's some back channel going on. But it's Turkey, it's Russia, and sometimes Iran. So the two Syrian allies and Turkey supposed to represent everybody else. And it's not an ideal situation, really, if you are worried about what the Assad regime might get up to. Meanwhile, back in Turkey, we've had a president who's been in power since 2002. He was initially a reformer, gung-ho about joining the EU. And then as he kept winning elections, his colors kept turning more and more religious, more and more nationalist. So you have an odd combination of Turkish nationalists who were never fond of the conservative religious people in Anatolia, which is the base of Erdogan. Now they are kind of joined together in an alliance, and it's the minorities and the secular Western, the people who remember Ataturk in the original Turkish Republic from the last century, they're the ones who are in the opposition and feel like they're losing ground all the time. So it's a very different kind of a Turkish leader. It's changing the face of Turkey, and he, although he's been in charge since 2002, he could, if he wins one more election, still be in charge in 2028. So, and conceivably, there is a tricky way he could stay in even longer. But and he's now a strong president. They passed a referendum last year whereby the president, which was more of a figurehead position, is now the chief executive. And while that's very similar to what we have in America, what's not similar is that the institutions have all been weakened, the judiciary, the legislature, even the military, which played a huge role there over the decades as a defender of the secular tradition, pro-Western tradition. So he's almost unchecked in terms of what he can do. He does remain in NATO and want to stay in NATO. That might be one check. He's no longer pushing to get into the EU, and they're no longer eager to have Turkey in there. So that kind of check and balance isn't so strong, which leaves this very unpredictable relationship between Erdogan and Trump, two very strong-willed people who sometimes behave erratically, I guess we could say. So where that leads, I don't know. It certainly makes it an interesting place to report from. There's plenty of news to cover, and I don't have time, honestly, to do it all. I just do my best. I think this is a fascinating time to be paying attention to news overseas, and I've been kind of heartened to see the students today and the attendance here. The people really do care about these very arcane and difficult to understand places. At least they were for me when I went over there to try and learn. Like I say, I kind of got thrown in on the deep end with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and it just kept going from there. So I don't really have a very long spiel about that, except I did want to make that point that I think it's important for people to pay attention, to keep supporting the media where you can, especially public radio, please. And I'd really rather just open it up to questions. So if you want to go right ahead, I'll take whatever you got. There were some great questions today from the students, by the way. So,
as we ask our questions, please do come up, form a line behind the mic if you want to. I'll start with a real hard hitter. Mm-hmm. Is there a grocery store product in Turkey that you will miss more than any other when you finally go on to a new assignment?
Boy, that's a tough one. Turkish food is great, but I don't know that there's anything unique. I don't know. That's a tough one.
Are you able to get enough peanut butter while you're abroad?
Oh, yeah, peanut butter. Turkish Delight's quite good, actually, yeah, for a little while, you know.
Very glad
to
hear.
In small doses.
Merhaba, iyi akşamlar.
Merhaba.
From Dayton, Ohio, but visiting my daughter, who lives here. My other daughter lives in Izmir.
Oh, yeah.
And she and her husband, who is Turkish, were in the United States when the coup attempt happened in 2016. There was grassroots speculation amongst... They're part of a kind of a expat local community. There was speculation that Erdogan orchestrated that really bad attempt in order to tighten his hold, to purge his military, and to jail more of his adversaries. What do you think?
Well, the circumstantial evidence is there. I don't know if anyone will ever know except historians. He did have a lovely, miraculous escape. He got his message out on a cell phone, an Apple phone, by the way, which he's now been threatening lately, but that's another story. He did say a day after it was put down, this is a gift from God, and that's when he launched his purge. So there are many Turks who believe that, if not orchestrated, that somehow he had advanced knowledge and used it to his advantage. I don't know. I don't think in near time we're going to have any dispositive evidence one way or another. There's no question it has been a huge purge, hundreds of thousands of people. Obviously, many of them are soldiers. Some of them are police. A lot of prosecutors, judges, academics, professors. It really has gotten to the point where people who espouse opposition views, who simply have political differences with Erdogan, they seem to be winding up in jail as well, which is very alarming. The media has been stifled or bought out in many cases by friends of Erdogan, so the pro-government line in Turkish media is very prominent. I think the purge is the big story from Turkey since 2016. Oh, and by the way, you were in the U.S. when it happened, so was I. I had been walking up a hiking trail in Petersburg, and I got all these phone messages on July 15th, 2016.
Yeah. On the eve of Yom Kippur, can you speculate on an Israeli-Palestinian solution?
No time soon. I could speculate that way. Yom Kippur today and tomorrow being celebrated. I don't know. I mean, I was there for the Intifada, and it was very, very tough. At the moment, we have an administration that's even more pro-Israel than usual. America's always been on Israel's side since 1948. Now we have cuts to the Gaza funding for the Palestinians, which is an attempt, I believe, to pressure Abbas and the Palestinians to get back to the table and talk about this peace plan that we still haven't seen yet, that Jared Kushner is supposedly working on. I suspect if and when they manage to get that started, that it will have a very difficult role. Certainly all the previous ones have, and I've heard nothing to suggest that this has anything new enough to make a difference.
Welcome home.
Thanks very much. It's great to be back.
What's the state of the media today, and what can we do to help preserve what we have left? For example, the invasion of all kinds of technology miscreants. The MIT Technology Review magazine this quarter is devoted to, can we preserve our democracy in the technical age? Are we going to wind up with just NPR and New York Times left? And do we just keep throwing money at you folks and all will be well?
You can certainly try. I don't know where the media is going. I mean, the technological changes are faster now. They're more rapid. But I think actually this is similar to what's happened in the past. And every time there's change, people wonder if it's going to survive. The advent, the growth of hacking and cyber crime and cyber misbehaving is certainly worrying. We'll all be watching Mr. Putin for the midterm election, see if there's anything that we can tie to him. I think that's going to keep going at some level. It's just bound to. The technology is there. It's harder to regulate. It's so broad and so quick. And how do you regulate it without stifling genuine free speech, genuine political speech? But I think the need for information and the interest will continue. I think we will continue to have some kind of media. We make fun maybe of some of the internet media sites now that don't seem to have many restrictions and a strict editorial process to make sure everything's accurate. But someday that's going to be how it all gets consumed. I mean, I think we're moving in that direction. So how it develops, that's going to be the interesting thing to watch.
Hi, my name is Frank Rue. Our son married an Iranian-American, and we were in Tehran celebrating their wedding basically the day the nuclear deal was signed.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a huge amount of optimism in Iran.
Yeah. Yeah.
When we walked around the streets, people would come up to us and ask where we were from, and they were very friendly towards Americans, which amazed us, actually.
Yeah.
And it seemed like there was some hope for a moderation in Iran then. So I guess my question of you is, do you think there is a real sort of moderate movement towards the West in Iran? And will this sanctions crush that and or perhaps let it bloom? I don't know.
A very tricky question. That I've experienced that as well. It was true well before the nuclear deal was agreed. Iranians love to talk to Americans. They especially want... They want us to know that they're not the way they're portrayed in the media back in the U.S. But I think this question of a big sea change, that's really difficult. I mean, Hassan Rouhani, the president, is a pragmatist. He's willing to talk to the outside world, but he's not a reformer. He's not the kind of guy who's going to change the theocracy that runs Iran. And the protests that have been going on since December, at least, are routinely put down and repressed very harshly. the supreme leader, a hardliner, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, is still the only guy in real charge of the important things, and nothing happens without his approval. So I suspect, especially with the Trump administration changing the rhetoric from the Obama era, let's talk, to now we're going to put sanctions back and all bets are off, I think the hardliners in Iran are now in the ascendancy, and they'll be putting pressure on Rouhani, who will be able to do even less in the last couple of years he's got in his second term. And the only question is, who follows him? There have been strong, moderate reform turnouts at the ballot box, which has been very interesting to watch. Whether that will happen again this time is a big question.
Can you give us a glimpse of the living in Iran and well in Turkey with the difficulty that those economies are going through?
Yeah, they're both having similar difficulties at the moment. Both the currencies are very depressed. And Mr. Erdogan in Turkey has a rather unique idea of how to deal with that. Most central banks would say when your currency is going down, you have to raise interest rates to shore it up. He says, oh, no, no, we're going to cut the interest rates further and get more growth in. That's his answer. He has lived on big mega projects. He wants to build a new canal to parallel the Bosphorus Strait. There's a new airport, just about the world's biggest, going in up on the Black Sea, tunnels under the Bosphorus. And that's how the economy, one way the economy has kept so strong, stronger than most European countries in for the recent years. But can that last is the question, and does he have a sustainable way of keeping the economic growth going? That's a really big question. It's harder to live in Iran than it is in Turkey, no question about it. The social repression, the political repression, and the inability to voice any dissent is much worse in Iran than it is in Turkey, although it exists in both places. The people there are very resilient, though, and they keep trying and keep hoping against hope.
Nice to see you, Peter.
And you?
The last time I saw Peter was in a jazz club in Istanbul, so it was nice of you to see several of us Alaskans who were visiting there. I just wanted to ask about what the situation is like now in Turkey for travelers. I was totally blown away by the country. I thought it was just fantastic, and the food, the people, the ruins, the everything about it I really liked. So what's it like for an American to go there now?
I would say it's fine myself. The majority of tourists to Turkey these days are not Americans. They're Russians, actually. They all come pouring in from the frozen steppe and go to the Aegean Sea to put on their Speedos and hang out and drink vodka. But the other thing that surprised me was when I found out when I got there in 2010, they had 1.3 million Iranians coming to Turkey every year, visa-free. And a lot of them went up to Europe, but a lot of them also went down to the beach and managed to get along with the Russians just fine. So, yeah, it's... But to answer your question, it's not dangerous for Americans. There have not been any attacks recently. A couple of years ago, there was a New Year's Eve bombing at a nightclub. And before that, there have been some other attacks. You might wonder if the Idlib situation happens in Syria and another set of millions of refugees come across the border, some percentage of those are probably going to be fighters. You know, will that cause more problems? Hard to predict completely, but it has been, for the last couple of years, very safe. And I would definitely encourage you to think about it. It's a lovely place to visit. Yeah, thanks, Kim.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Glad you're here. To what extent has the abdication of American leadership in the Middle East provided a way in for the Russians, particularly in Syria and the rest of the Middle East?
Well, I think it's no secret that the Trump administration's top priority in Syria is to get out as quickly as possible. That's not 100% different from the way Obama looked at it either, I should say. But it's more pronounced and more clear to everyone. And the Russian insertion of their air power into that conflict was a huge turning point. I mean, it really was a game changer. And it ensured, as it turns out now, the survival for a while at least of Bashar al-Assad, who is going to be intent, I believe, on taking revenge against all those who opposed him. So we may be nearing the end of this multilateral proxy war that's been going on, but certainly the violence there, it could go on for quite some time if the United Nations or somebody doesn't manage to create some kind of a peace that can be enforced. I'm not sure what the American play would be if they wanted to get back into it at this point. But yeah, definitely it's become a really difficult problem to solve.
Hi, Frankie Pelafont. I'm curious if we could get a broader view also just about the stands, Afghanistan and Pakistan, and maybe looking forward, how they're impacting or not, or just if you can provide a little picture there as well, what we ought to be thinking about or looking at there.
Well, that really impacted Iran, which is how I come through it. That's one of my countries of interest. So if you go down to the southern part of around Lake Van and down towards the border in Turkey, you will find just about every auto mechanic shop is run by an Iranian or an Afghani. An Afghani who escaped to Iran, which is their neighbor, and during that war, and stayed there as long as they could. And then when they couldn't stand that, they climbed over the mountains and moved to Turkey. So they are the last wave, you know, the pre-Syrian wave of refugees and displaced people. And, you know, I was once at some exhibition, and General Petraeus was up on the stage, and he was fielding questions, and Afghanistan was the subject, and a member of the House of Lords stood up in the back and said, he wondered if General Petraeus had any advice on how it is we're going to win the hearts and minds of these peoples whose main goal in life is to be left alone. One of those questions that really doesn't have a good answer, and Petraeus didn't have one. But yeah, these tensions are going to have ripple effects all around the region, and Iran, Turkey, and then Europe and the West all get sucked into it.
Following on Jim Clark's question, a very good book I read was All the Shah's Men, sort of explains I don't know if you agree, but it gives you a little history on how, you know, our interests after World War II and the British interests after World War II were concerns about Russia and the Soviet Union taking over Iran. And so we overthrew the government and put the Shah back in. So now, with us out of the picture pretty much, and the Russians helping certainly in Syria as allies of Iran, and the Chinese, when we were in Iran, the Chinese are everywhere building and what do you think will be the long-term relationship with Russia and Iran and China and Iran versus the U.S. and Iran?
At the moment, we're pushing them all together. But certainly in the case of Iran and Russia and China, who were party to the nuclear deal as well. That book by Stephen Kinsler you mentioned goes into the toppling of Prime Minister Mossadegh, I guess, or was he president in those days? Anyway, he was the elected leader, and he nationalized the oil concession that was held by the oil company that is now known as BP. And they went to the president of the U.S., Eisenhower must have been, and asked him to intervene, and he said, I don't really think so. But then they went and found the Dulles brothers in the State Department, and they said, oh, yeah, we can do that. So they sent Kermit Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's nephew, to foment this unrest, and they managed, through disinformation and passing around of some money, managed to topple the prime minister who'd been elected and done this terrible thing of nationalizing the oil. So that kind of ran. And that, I think, the point that I take away from that now in 2018 is that Iranians still remember that like it was yesterday. That's not ancient history. So that just makes things all the harder. You know, Americans might remember the Islamic Revolution and the hostage crisis, but, you know, they remember Mossadegh, and it just exacerbates the problem, the polarization of ideas and talking past each other. It's, very, very difficult.
Hello. Hi. I watched your lecture earlier today at UAS on the live streaming, and you had talked about how you had predicted Mubarak way earlier, but you never got credit for it because it didn't get printed. But I was wondering if you had any early predictions about the president in Turkey, and if you had potentially predicted that at all, because over the 10 years.
Let's see. What I'd said about predicting Mubarak was I had written that there was a chance of an uprising, and people should watch out. But that story never ran because it was part of a pre-written obituary for Hosni Mubarak. So I was a genius in my own mind. But in terms of Turkey, I mean, I showed up in 2010. He'd already been in power for 8 years at that point. And now it's another eight. He's still in power. And he just started a five-year term. If he wins in 2023, which is going to be, by the way, the centenary of Ataturk's republic, and Erdogan has always had as his goal to be the guy in charge on the 100th anniversary. If he wins that year, and at this point I don't see why he wouldn't, he's in charge till 2028. And technically there's a way the parliament could call snap elections a year before the end of his term and he could win another 5 years. So that's certainly possible he could be in charge well into the 2030s. And I can't predict anything different based on the evidence I've seen so far. He just manages to control and win every election. Will I ever get to the point and say, you know, can we still call ourselves a democracy if this guy's still in charge for so long? I don't know. I wonder that myself.
Can you speak to the topic of refugees? I think Turkey's supposed to be kind of a pass-through country, but I'm not sure that refugees are actually passing through.
They certainly were early on. There were millions who passed through and went to Greece and then got up through the Balkans and into Western Europe. They all wanted to go to Germany, as it happened, and Merkel was the one leader who didn't immediately say, keep them out. You know, Orban in Hungary and some of the other right-wing leaders were very strong about putting up fences and kicking them out and keeping them away. Germany tried to accept more than anybody else, but the backlash now against Merkel has gotten very huge. There's reports of migrants being beaten. And now with this prospect of another 3 million coming, potentially, I think the anti-immigration side of Europe is really on the rise, which leaves countries like Turkey and Greece and Spain and Italy stuck because they can come this far and then they can go no further. So Turkey is now desperately trying to create a situation where they can make parts of northern Syria safe so they can create the camps over on that side and put them back into Syria. And they have been doing that for quite some time. Now if there's this attack on Idlib, that's not going to be tenable. They're all going to come rushing back. And what happens then, I don't know.
What do you see as the fate of the Kurds in this area going forward, just given the various tensions and the fact that they've never had a country?
Another easy question. Thanks very much. Yeah. So the Kurds, very brief story. They have a traditional homeland in their belief, parts of Turkey, parts of Iraq, parts of Iran, and parts of Syria. That all makes Kurdistan, and pretty much every Kurd I've ever talked to believes that should be their homeland. The majority of them are not willing to go and fight over it, though. But there is a militant group called the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as the PKK, that has fought an insurgency, well, a war for, they believe, their homeland since the mid-1980s. And it almost got solved, I would like to say, halfway towards being solved in the middle of Erdogan's reign up till now. He started a peace process. He was having direct talks with the PKK, which was always taboo before. And then all of a sudden, he lost an election, or he got a very small majority in one election, not enough to control parliament the way he wanted to. And all of a sudden, the peace talks are over, the war was restarted, and he ever since has become more and more nationalist. And the Kurds are back to square one now. I think the chance of making peace with Erdogan are very slim at the moment. And it would take, I would say, a pretty hefty international, multinational effort to change that. And I just don't see the rest of the world paying enough attention to the Kurdish problem at this point for that to happen. So, yeah, not much good news on that front.
Are there any easy questions about the Middle East? And it seems like for my lifetime anyway, each issue is so multi-layered and complicated. And how do you sift through that as a reporter? Or have you developed a method after years of covering this region?
One of the reasons there's no easy answers, I think, is the prominence of religion in the area and how it affects people and the way they think. As someone told me when I first got to Jerusalem, you know, you can resolve a land dispute. You can figure that out. But if it's sacred ground, then forget it. All bets are off. And so that has been a big part of the problem. It also could be an organizing principle for some kind of solution in a positive world. That's a little pie in the sky, I suppose. But it's a powerful force, and it's not being used for peace at the moment, unfortunately, I guess is the way I'd say it.
What is your assessment of the belligerence of President Trump and him bringing John Bolton in and, the rhetoric that they use? Do you foresee that turning into action? And I guess my follow-up to that is it seems to me that my daughter-in-law is Iranian American, that the Iranian people are very proud Persians, and that if they feel more under attack with the sanctions and even military action potentially, that would be one thing that would really help unify them, even though they're very different in their views from the right and the left, conservative.
In terms of more aggression and pressure, I mean, that has translated to action. Those people he's brought in, they moved the embassy in Jerusalem from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. There's the pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal and the reimposition of sanctions. The aggressive foreign policy is being carried out in deeds, not just in hot rhetoric. At the moment, as I said earlier, in the case of Iran, that is putting the hardliners in the ascendancy. It's not really unifying. Your average Iranian, I would say, certainly those who vote, want someone more moderate. They picked Rouhani not because he was the closest thing to a moderate they could have on the ballot. That's how they control the elections in Iran. They don't always, as in the case of Ahmadinejad, maybe tinker with the vote, but they do handpick the candidates that are allowed to run in the first place. So that has pretty much the same effect, although they did go as moderate as they were allowed to go, and I think they would go further if they were allowed.
So you've spoken plenty about somewhat degrees of failed democracies throughout the rest of the world. How close would you describe us in our present state to being, how close are we to being a perfect representative republic? And is there another example of a different country that you would compare us to that we might be similar to?
I don't know about comparisons. You can find plenty of people in Western Europe who will point out flaws in the American democracy. It's hardly a perfect system. It has institutions, though, that have saved it, I would say, from people who might not be the best leaders, should I put it that way. This is the problem in a place like Turkey. Erdogan is in charge. He's a very strong-willed guy, and the institutions are not strong enough to stand up to him. The judiciary has been somewhat gutted. He's been appointing lots of judges who are friendly to himself. The media has become very docile. The military, which used to be a bastion of secularism, has been put back to the barracks, as they say. So I would say the American judicial system, we'll see what this new Supreme Court's like, I suppose, on that front. I would say at this point, the institutions of America are still stronger.
Just had a couple questions, I guess, combined together. But I'm wondering about the Kurds on the south of the border and Iraq as a bigger story. From what I understand, it's in complete, utter disarray with corruption. Nothing's getting done, and patronage is basically keeping the economy alive. For one, and then I'm wondering about the Shia and Sunni sort of battle that the Saudis kind of seem to be pushing. Are they hoping to draw us into war against Iran?
The Saudis. Okay.
And then the third one is just kind of a comment on NPR, I guess. I'm sure you remember Click and Clack, and at the end of many of their programs, they'd say something. I know that Nina Totenberg is probably rolling around in her chair, when we say this, but we're with NPR. But they always did something that I thought would be really wonderful for the news part of the organization. They did Stump the Chump, and John Bolton's name just came up, and I'd heard him many times as a talking head on All Things Considered and other programs, and it would just seem, I can't remember remember him ever actually being right. And it'd be kind of fun to play those clips back and say, you know, how'd this one turn out in Iraq? How'd this one turn out? And so
it's true. If you could get people to remember and go back a ways, you could have some wonderful counter arguments.
So it's just the Kurds and then how the Saudis going to play in Yemen. And do you think their new prime minister is going to, you know, get his wings clipped? I like to call him King Salmon, being Alaskan, but
Yes, the young Mohammed is very strong-willed. He's very young by Saudi standards to be. He's not technically in charge, but he is essentially running things, and that's pretty normal for the crown prince. They sort of get a practice time before they become the king. I don't know about drawing us into war. I mean, they're using American weapons in a lot of cases, and they have the backing of Washington in their war against the Houthi rebels in Yemen, who are backed by Iran. And both sides have committed some quite egregious damage. That country is very poor. It's running out of water. And, I'm not quite sure how they're going to survive this. It's a very difficult situation. The KRG, Kurdish Regional Government in Iraq, I'm sure there's corruption there. I have no doubt about it. For the Kurds, they are a shining example of how they can run their own country, even though it's not. It's part of northern Iraq. They call it, Kurdistan, but that's not the official name. They are in charge, though, and have been for years, and probably will continue to be for quite some time, although Baghdad has been trying to take control of the borders, and they had a referendum that really upset people, and both in Turkey and in Baghdad, a referendum saying, oh, by the way, we still want our country, you know, that big country with all the pieces of your land someday. So they've been having a difficult time at the moment, but I don't think they'll be giving up on their aspirations. I also don't think there's much of a way for them to get to them anytime soon.
As President Erdogan sort of tightens his grip on the country, I'm guessing he's becoming more fundamental in his Islam.
I wouldn't necessarily say that. His brand of Islam is like the Muslim Brotherhood, which I'm not competent to give you a perfect spectrum, but it's somewhere in the center right. It's far from the fundamentalist ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Nusra Front. He went to Egypt after the Arab Spring, and he was saying, he went on TV, a national televised interview, and said, you know, I'm a pious Muslim. I run a secular state. It works fine. And he was practically run out of the country. They didn't want to hear that. That's not what they wanted. That's when the Muslim Brotherhood was in charge for the very brief period after Mubarak, before the military moved back in with General Sisi. More religious is what it is. The difference is it was always very secular in Turkey. And Erdogan started focusing on getting into Europe, doing pro-Western reforms. Everybody just breathed a sigh of relief and said, oh, this guy's fine. And now, year after year, there's more religion. First he got, which was actually, you could say, a civil rights issue. He won the right to wear the Islamic headscarf in a public job, if you work at the post office or in a ministry. And he has done more to advance Muslim rights and religious rights, and not so much for anybody else. So that is the way I see his religion being manifested. But it, in the great scheme of, you know, Islamic religions and where they go, Turkey is far from the most extreme. Yeah.
Is that having an effect on, say, college-educated women? Are they being sort of crimped by this, or have you seen much change in that department?
That has always been a problem in Turkey. Under the pro-Western military governments, that's more cultural than religious. I don't think it's gotten appreciably worse, although in some parts of Anatolia maybe it has. In small villages it's still very, very difficult.
What is the role that Turkey plays in the world, and why is that something important for Americans to understand?
Well, its location has always been pretty crucial. It's, you know, right in between the Middle East. It's very close to the stands on the way to Russia. It's right on the edge of Europe, you know, came sort of halfway to being part of Europe at some point. So it's involved in a whole lot of difficult issues just by virtue of where it is and also by virtue of the political ambitions they have. And the reason I think it matters to Americans is because problems in that region can, if they blow up and lead to war, you know, young men and women are going to be in harm's way again. So hopefully that will never happen, but you certainly can't rule it out. And that's a good reason to pay attention, I would say.
Earlier you said that you just kind of got thrown into covering war. What was that learning curve like?
Very steep. I mean... Well, I mean, you either learn how to survive or, you know, that's it. It's all done. So I managed to be fortunate. There was other journalists there who had been in conflict zones before. So you didn't have to go completely on your own. I had a very nice older guy as a translator, worked for a newspaper there. And he knew a lot of people in small villages in the West Bank, which was where all the action was. They were taking over the West Bank, sort of city, village by village. The Israeli army was moving through and taking it over and occupying it again, basically undoing the stuff that had been done in the Oslo Accords. And so that was my experience. I've said this, some of you have heard this before. It's the only place I've ever been shot at, but they were warning shots, and they were good enough to not hit me, so... Yeah, but it was quite a learning curve.
Hi, I have all sorts of questions, but here's one I was thinking about as you were taking a sip of your water. Is water as a resource a political aspect that comes into hard play there in the stands and in Turkey, Syria, Eritrea, et cetera? And can you elaborate a little on that if you're shaking your head? Yes.
It is. I'm less familiar with the what's happening in the stands, but in Turkey... you know, they have the Euphrates there and the Tigris, and they're building dams. And it's a real problem for Iraq. It could be a problem for Syria as well. It is a problem of real tensions in other areas I've been. They've been on the receiving end, you know, and losing water as the dams go in. Here the Turks are gaining or preserving water supply. And the treaty that governs how these things happen... No, it's not one treaty, but there is no perfect legal mechanism to make sure that this is done fairly. So it's one of those things that has to be done with diplomacy. And, yeah, the Iraqis are quite concerned. Baghdad's very worried about the water situation.
So as you said, it's important for Americans to know what's going on in the rest of the world, and I think it's really easy to just pay attention to our own little bubble right here. And I suppose I'm wondering... Since you've been a correspondent in Turkey and Iran, do you think it's getting worse or better, especially with how much importance we have and how much attention we pay to news on the internet?
Well, let's see. I don't know exactly about the internet's impact, but I would say certainly the Trump phenomenon has made it harder to get international stories on the air, including at NPR. There's just so much to cover in Washington. But we keep trying, and they're not bad. They've gotten over their initial shock, and they're starting to balance things out a little bit more. That is a problem. And I do wish that more attention would be paid to international news. I mean, of course, I'm biased, but I think these visits I've had here in the last couple of days have been very reassuring, actually.
What about climate change, and how do you see the countries over there dealing with it? Do they talk about it? Are they aware of it? I mean, I've, you know, heard some stuff about southern parts of Iran will become uninhabitable, and I'm, you know, sure Saudi Arabia and some of those places.
Well, those marshlands in southern Iraq are amazing. It's an amazing ecosystem, and they've been destroyed more than once. Saddam drained them at one point just out of spite. He didn't like the people who were living down there. And now climate change could do the same thing, apparently. I was reading an article about that the other day. It's that would be a real shame. And certainly desertification in that part of the world is a big issue. And I don't think they're equipped, even if they wanted to deal with it, I'm not sure they're equipped to do much.
So a strategy that our president very often uses when he wants to distract from an issue is essentially... doing a denial of service attack by flooding the media with a bunch of whatever. I won't use any colorful language here. How do you believe we should deal with that and keep focused on the issues that we should be paying attention to?
Well, I mean, that's a sort of an eternal battle, information wars. I mean, it's been going on since the days when radio was the dominant medium. But it's become, with the internet and how rapidly information moves now, it's become more and more of an issue. It's much easier for one important person or one person with the right access to flood a much greater sphere with information, misinformation, disinformation. So I think supporting, you know, reliable, relatively balanced folks who try to tell you what's really going on is the best thing to do. But that's not going to stop it. I mean, it's the best defense I can think of.
Can't let you out of here without a couple more.
Well, I've got a few more minutes as it happens.
Tell us about the Black Sea. Yeah. How does the world look from those in the Black Sea, the strategic importance, and what's likely to happen there?
What's likely to happen? That's a tough question. It's a beautiful part of the world. That's where Turkey grows all of its tea, all of its famous Turkish tea. I was in Ukraine, right? I was in Crimea right before Mr. Putin annexed that a few years back, and it's just a very, and there was all these stories and histories of, you know, submarines pulling up and going off to war. And still, I can get up on a Sunday morning and my house overlooks the Bosporus, the apartment I'm renting, and you can see a Russian submarine, you know, gliding by on its way to the waters off of Syria. It really is a reminder of how, what a critical waterway that is. And there's only 6 or 7 states who are part of this treaty that are allowed to use the Bosporus, and Turkey really has not very much to say about who can use it and who can't. It's like the Strait of Hormuz. It's an international waterway that's governed internationally. It's the Black Sea is also, I don't know if it's going to be threatened by this project they call the Crazy Canal that Erdogan now wants to do, which is another strait from the Sea of Marmaris up into the Black Sea. Is that going to cause different currents? Is it somebody worried that it would drain the Black Sea? I don't know. And the Black Sea, by the way, is this very salty sea for about this much of it, certain percentage of it, and underneath it is deeply polluted, awful stuff. It's hard to believe that fish even survive in the top layer. But a lot of the oxygen down low is gone, and there's a lot of heavy pollution there. So anyway, fascinating area.
I have to grab onto an answer that you gave just a couple ago about find a reliable media source. For the past few years, I've been struggling to do just that. What most people do when they look for a media source is look for something that mirrors or echoes what their personal values and feelings are. And in order to fight that, or not necessarily fight, but to argue thoughtfully and intellectually against that, you have to have good raw data, whereas people will say, oh, that's not a reliable source, you can't use that, my source is reliable. Where is a reliable source?
Your point about the echo chamber is good, and it's certainly one of the phenomena. It's being accelerated with the advent of online media. The ability to simply look where you want to look is much greater now. And if you want to avoid news that you don't like or channels that have stories you don't like, it's much easier to do that. I mean, you used to have to listen to the radio and you got what you got, or watch television and you got what you got, or your newspaper. Now you can really pick somebody who says what you already think, and you can just shut everything else out if you want to. That's always been a problem to some extent, but it's getting worse and worse now. And I wish I had an easy answer for combating it, but it's an inexorable process that you just have to be vigilant against.
I miss Walter Cronkite.
So in this area where social media really kind of controls a lot of the aspects of news, we've seen some prominent bans of what I think it's fair to consider some fringe figures, such as like Alex Jones of InfoWars. But the stated reasons for those bans were not defamation or threats of violence or anything like that in most of these cases. They were rather for hate speech. So these social media platforms have become, the executives of them have essentially become the arbiters of who gets an internet presence versus who doesn't. Do you believe that we should regulate these platforms as public utilities?
Boy, that's above my pay grade a bit, but that's a big question. And it is certainly true that the pressure now to do things like cut Alex Jones off of his internet platforms without prosecuting him for anything, there's no crime that's being alleged here that's been committed, is that a slippery slope? You know, where else could that be applied, depending on who's in charge of the social media platforms sometime in the future? I mean, are we going to be at the whim of Jeff Bezos and other folks like that? I don't know. And the other thing, when you mentioned Fringe and outside, and it reminded me of the Walter Cronkite question, is on the other hand, I would have to say that there is also a lot more diversity in your sources of information. And I think that's a good thing. But there is this question of getting into a rabbit hole you have to worry about.
Kind of areas of fascination. An area that I have a unique fascination about is Uzbekistan. Have you been there? Maybe not. And what do you think their place is in the Middle East as for effect in international?
Well, news? I mean, in the Caucasus in general, and the stands probably more so than the Middle East. But a lot of those countries have rather authoritarian leaders, and not all of them, but a few of them, and it makes change very difficult. They're former Soviet Socialist Republics, so having strong men in charge doesn't seem that different. In fact, people say that about Turkey. You know, they like having a strong man in charge. Many Turks would tell you that, you know, frankly. But where they play a larger role in the future, I don't know. I don't think they have the leverage at this point to impact bigger regional issues, but maybe in the future they will.
We appreciate you being here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
But I want to ask you a question about Iran.
Iran.
Are Americans free to travel in Iran? Is it fairly safe? Have you traveled extensively in Iran?
I have traveled. As a journalist, it's a little bit more controlled. Tourists can go. My wife has gone to many places, several cities that I have yet to visit, because I have to apply as a journalist, and they're a little more careful about where they let me go. But I've been up to Isfahan, which is a beautiful city, and to Qum, where some of the clerics hang out, and some areas south of Tehran. An interesting country. It has water problems. There's more desert there than there used to be, but some of their cities are just beautiful. And if you're a tourist, a visitor, yes, there are many. I wouldn't say you have freedom of movement per se, but there are many, many places where they're eager to have you, from Tabriz in the north right on down south.
I'm glad we get to end on a positive note. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was NPR correspondent Peter Kenyon in this Juno World Affairs Council presentation, produced in collaboration with 360 North. It was recorded September 18, 2018 at 360 in Juno, with major support from the Prospector Hotel and additional support from AELNP, Core Alaska Kensington Mine, Haight & Associates, Sea Alaska, the University of Alaska Southeast, and Wastman & Associates.